I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We'll be hearing from three famous Wisconsin theatrical institutions in the course of this hour, beginning with the American Players Theater in Spring Green, famous most of all for its Shakespeare, but ranging broadly in its offerings. And we're going to hear scenes from one of their contemporary plays. The director is Brenda DeVita, and the players are Nate Berger and Laura Rook. And the name of the play is Mary's Wedding. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Well, Brenda, as the director, you're probably the one who can give us the most objective overview of how this play works and what it's about.
I don't know how objective I am about anything. I think the play is it's a dreamscape. It's a memory play, and it's a play about a young woman who is dealing with circumstances that were beyond her control, the love of her life, and World War I. So the hugest things in the world you can think of, which is love and war, and this young girl's experience of that.
But when you say it's a memory play, Brenda, does this suggest some kind of like disjointed sequence,
yes,
chronology?
It's very nonlinear. And in fact, the poetry on the page that Stephen has done is create a kind of echoing of certain images and certain phrases and certain instances that are explode kind of in your heart and in your mind. It's a really masterfully done. It's so simple. It's really deceiving on the page. It looks very simple. It's very complicated. It's the hardest thing to do simple, right? So that's what we're working on. We're working on trying to just be just present enough to what he's after inside of these this darling couple and this beautiful relationship.
Play told from her point of view then?
Yes, I think we have to say yes to that, even though her point of view is in a dream and it's out of her control in some sense. I mean, she cannot control her dream. If she could, I think it would be a different dream.
Sure, well, yeah. Well, not many people can control their dreams.
But yeah, it's her point of view that she is telling us, yeah, that she's sharing her life through this dream.
And what kind of perspective do we get from your character, Nate?
From Charlie. It's interesting because the play is kind of split into memories that she has of real interactions she had with Charlie. So there are literal versions of him in the play. Like, this is an actual conversation we had. And then sometimes he becomes sort of a dream version of Mary because we're talking in the present after these things happened, and it's a dream version of Charlie in Mary's head. So it's interesting. I kind of get to play both characters too.
Yeah, there you go.
But he's a Canadian farmhand. He lives with his father in the middle of the country, and he's grown up in the teens, the 1910s, and is susceptible to the propaganda of patriotism and decides to join the war effort. And that's sort of like where the play lives, is in between that choice and his love for this person who makes him more than who he is.
So we have a scene now between the two of you.
Yeah, and this scene is it starts with Charlie leaving for war, and it's an imagined version of that, and we get to meet Laura's other character, which is my lieutenant commander in the actual war, who's a real person in real life,
yes.
Gordon Muriel Flowerdew.
Oh, really? What a wonderful name.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I see him on an ocean liner. I am watching him sail away. The war is on, and the Canadians are sailing for England, then France, and before long, the heart of Germany.
I can't believe it. We are finally joining the fight. Me, Trooper Edwards, 1st Troop, C Squadron, the Lord Strathcona's horse regiment.
The strange thing is, I was never here. I was at home in my room. I was never here with the people on the shore. This is not how we said goodbye. When Charlie sailed, I was 2 days away by train. Oh, but it's like a great big birthday party. The sun is shining, the St. Lawrence is glittering. There are children waving and babies in mothers' arms. All those arms and voices.
30,000 men, 7,000 horses on 38 ocean liners. What do they do when they see us coming?
The bands and pipes play across the waves, and the men on the decks all wave back.
Look at that. Isn't that something?
I'll see you, Charlie.
I'll charge the Germans for you. Remember me, and before long, I'll be home.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Hooray! Hooray!
Hooray! I'll see you, Mary. I'll be home soon.
I'm going to marry that girl.
Dear Mary, the weather has been good every day out of the St. Lawrence. Someone volunteered, first troop, to make the crossing on the ship with the horses. Every inch of the boat is filled with them, so they've got us sleeping up on deck in hammocks.
The ships move like ghosts, steadily humming through the Atlantic. They're not pretty white like I remember them from when I was a girl. They've been painted gray to make them harder to spot by enemy U-boats. Not a ship has a light on. No bands are playing in golden ballrooms. There is only the steady hum of the ships and the breathing of men in hammocks and horses warming the walls with their bodies. There are thousands of stars, the moon, and the single coal of a cigarette farther along the deck. It glows and dims on a face before flicking and falling to the silver waves. Nice night.
Yes, it is that. You on watch?
Just out for a walk.
Is that you?
Of course it's me.
Sergeant Flowered you?
And in the dream, I am that sergeant.
I'm sorry, sir. I thought you were someone else.
Oh, do you think I was a girl in a nightie? As you were, man. And don't call me sir. I work for a living. You on watch?
I was earlier. Now I just can't sleep.
What's the problem?
I was just thinking.
What about?
A girl. Sergeant.
Well, if you're going to be up all night thinking, that's the best thing to be thinking about. Your first crossing, Edwards.
Yes, Sergeant. This is the first time I've seen the ocean. I've heard good things about it, though.
It's very calm. Bright.
Blue.
It was like this when I crossed over to Canada.
Where from?
From England.
Yeah. Well, you can see for miles. You'd think if they were out there, if the U-boats were out there, they could see us pretty good. If they were near here looking for us, they'd have some easy shooting.
Well, that's why we don't smoke on deck. What's her name? Your girl's name?
Mary Sergeant.
Mary Sergeant?
No, Mary Chalmers. I don't know any Mary Sergeant.
Charlie and Mary.
Mary and Charlie. Doesn't really ring, does it?
It rings just fine. Try going through your life with a name like Flowerdew. Gordon Muriel Flowerdew. They used to call me Flowers when I was a boy. I just told you, so now I imagine it'll be all over the regiment before we see land.
Yeah, I won't tell the regiment your nickname if you don't tell them that I was afraid and I couldn't sleep.
Listen, Charlie, we're horse soldiers. Sailing isn't our kind of war. We'll be on land soon enough, back on our horses where we belong. Then if we get to France and the Germans before the war is over, they'll be in for it, eh?
Maybe we'll take them in a charge. Then they'll be in for it.
Can I give you some advice? From someone with some experience of dreaming of someone far away? Don't think about her too much. You won't be able to see anything else. You'll see her in everyone. Everywhere you look.
I already do.
Get some sleep. We've got a big day ahead of us tomorrow. Feeding horses and shoveling... There's a lot of shoveling, let me tell you.
Yes, Sergeant.
There's a lot of bags to be carried as well.
Yes, Sergeant.
Rest those shoulders.
I'll try.
And it's a story about playfulness, a story about youth, of course, a story to some extent about innocence, but a story about World War I, too. Mm-hmm. So is there some inevitable disillusionment that comes up in this play?
Yeah, I think there absolutely is. But what's interesting about it, too, is that, like we talked about a little bit earlier, the whole play is sort of imagined from Mary's perspective. And so a lot of the disillusionment that happens to Charlie is her assumption about what happens to his brain over the course of these interactions that she can't possibly imagine.
Sure, a good dramatic tension there.
It's really cool because there's a lot of, like, because they're based in real World War One battles. So there's the Battle of Festubert is prominently mentioned, and the Battle at Morel Wood. And those were two huge turning points. And he was in this play in both of those conflicts. And so I think, and Laura can obviously speak to this better than I can, but I think it's better, I think it's about the context of those dreams is some of what Mary may have read about these famous conflicts buffeting up against her imagination of what Charlie may have undergone.
Sure.
And where those truths collide.
And the letters.
And the letters that she gets from him. Yeah. But there certainly is a lot of growing up that has to happen.
So you picked a second scene here from this play, illustrating.
Yeah, we're going to jump later into the play. And as we've learned, it's not linear. Yeah, we're going to go into, it's funny that you brought up the disillusionment because it is them growing up pretty fast, as young people do when they're faced with these extraordinary circumstances. And I think Mary is, starts the play and starts her life as a young woman who believes deeply, deeply in love. And as Brenda said, you're faced with the exact opposite thing of this war and this violence. And so this is them figuring out what that is. What's the worst thing you've ever done, other than disobeying Mother?
Other than that, I don't know. I'll tell you when I do it. What was it? What's that look?
Nothing.
No, I can see it in your eyes. It's not good, is it?
No. No, I shouldn't have asked. Forget I mentioned it.
Not now, I can't. You have to tell me, please. Tell me.
If you really want to know, I'll tell you what it is.
How do you know?
You told me in your letter today.
I really want to know.
You finally saw a German soldier. Please, Charlie, we don't have to talk about this.
Tell me.
On patrol, coming back 10 yards from your barbed wire, coming back through no man's land. You looked back before going into sleep.
Did you see that? Right there, see? Right there, Sergeant. Did you see him?
Who is it?
A scout or a sniper?
One of ours?
No. I don't know. I don't know. No. What should we do?
We drop him. If he crosses that line, take him.
I see. Go back. Come on, go back. Go back, turn around, go back.
The sniper, the ghost, the German person came closer from puddle to puddle.
Go back, come on.
And you wished he'd go back.
Come on, go back.
You wished he would, but he kept disappearing and appearing closer, like he was trying to catch up to your patrol. Until he crossed the line.
Go back.
You held your breath. Then flowers touched your shoulder. And your rifle made the sound of one quick stroke of an axe chopping wood.
There was a splash, too. A splash when he dropped into the water.
Through your sights you saw this, while the spent casing was still hot and smoking in the barrel, still pointed where he'd been standing. He bobbed up like he was looking up in a lake in the summer with the water ringing out around him. But then, slowly, he floated over onto his front.
It's the worst thing I ever did.
Oh, look, Charlie, how pretty the night is! The stars are coming out. Look there.
Yeah, it is pretty.
Another fine lesson. Have I learned everything there is to learn?
Oh, you've got her jumping fences. I've never been able to make her do that.
Really? No.
True. True, across my heart. On our first lesson after the tea, I would have never thought you'd be a better writer than me, but here you are.
You flatterer.
No flattery. You're an excellent student.
You're an excellent teacher. Charles. Charlie Edwards.
Mary Chalmers.
There is something I'd like to say to you.
What?
Charlie,
You what?
Thank you for the lessons.
Oh, that's what you wanted to say?
Something like that, yes. Good night, Charlie. Every time we get away together, it's over too soon. I tell him so many things, but when we reach Mother's house, there is always so much more to tell. It feels as though I hadn't told him a thing. But always the three words I want to say, I don't. Every night he drops me off, I lie in bed rehearsing the words for the next time I see him. It is all our little secret, we think. But Mother knows. Nobody is so keen to get the post, and no one takes that long to do it. Wake up, Charlie. Wake up.
Are we going over again, Sergeant?
No, Trooper, we're not going over. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine.
How are your feet? All right? Keeping them dry?
Yeah.
At least one of us is. Were you dreaming?
Yeah. About the German that we shot on patrol.
Don't think so much. Don't let yourself think so much.
I wasn't thinking. That's the trouble. I was dreaming.
Well, dream about this then. I've got news. We're relieved. So pack up, 15 minutes.
Wait, are we getting our horses back?
It's not that news. We get to go out, rest, clean up for a couple weeks, then we're back in the line.
Where?
Here, or somewhere else, I don't know.
In the line, though?
In the line. Where else?
It's a whimsical play and a poignant play, and a play in which two actors play three characters, and the two of them seem to share that third character. There are some very clever things going on behind the scenes, but some lovely characters, too, is Mary's Wedding by a contemporary Canadian playwright. And we've heard these scenes from an upcoming production by the American Players Theater of Mary's Wedding. And our actors have been Nate Berger and Laura Rook, and the director of the event is also with us today, and that's Brenda DeVita. Thanks, one and all, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Next, we'll be going to Ten Chimneys for a couple of scenes of plays by Noel Coward. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. And now we'll go back to a conversation and some acting involving James Pickering and Angela Iannone. It took place at Ten Chimneys, the home of Wisconsin's Broadway stars Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne. We recorded scenes from two plays associated with Lunt and Fontanne on that occasion. First, The Guardsman, a comedy by Ferenc Molnár.
Now, this first of the Lunt and Fontanne scenes that you're going to be doing for us from The Guardsman.
Yes.
And that actually is the only film that they ever did was The Guardsman, right?
The only film that they did together. There were a few later television films for the Hallmark Hall of Fame series, I believe. And there was a broadcast of The Great Sebastians, but I don't think you can call that a film. This was an official film. They were both nominated for Oscars for it. He for Best Leading Man and she for Best Actor and Best Actress.
As they called them back then. Now that you're all actors, isn't that the proper terminology? Men and women alike are all actors?
But I prefer actor, yes.
Now, about The Guardsman and the fact that that was their only film, there is a famous quotation, I think, from Lynn, right, who said, you know, because they were theater actors and they were used to the immediacy of the theater and the immediacy of the response and just having to do the thing one time straight through on stage. And when asked if they wouldn't do some more films, she said, my dear, we can be bought. We cannot be bored. And so that's why, just the one film in which they right. both acted. They did do some radio drama together, though, the
yes.
Theater Guild on the Air, which is, you can get it online or occasionally hear it on a Saturday or Sunday night on Wisconsin Public Radio. They did several plays together for that, including, I think, The Guardsman was one of them. Mm-hmm. But what's the premise of the play?
The premise of the play is that there is an acting couple. They are married about a year, I think, at the time this play takes place. And she has what was known in those days as a past, which makes him a little insecure in her affection. So he dresses himself up as a Russian guardsman and seduces her, tries to seduce her away from her husband. And then he arranges to be out of town playing Hamlet for a few days, so that she can arrange an assignation with him at the opera. So they meet in the opera box, and he proposes this relationship. And she says she will meet him the next night in her house at 5 o'clock and give him her decision. But it looks like it's going to be a yes. So he comes back from his tour early, strolls in and says, oh, I'm back. Do you have anything planned? And she says, no, I've got nothing. So he sets up his traveling trunk behind her on the couch, the way that it's staged, and then proceeds to get on all of the guardsmen, beard and wig and outfit, and then as he's talking to her, stands up and then begins using the guardsman's Russian accent. So it's this beautiful, beautiful, very clever play that's all about how do you trust and how far would you go for a real first kiss? This scene that we're going to read takes place just after he has stood up from behind his dressing trunk in full regalia, and she turns and looks at him, and this is the first thing that she says. Good afternoon, Prince. I began to think you were not coming.
Yes?
How was the ball at the palace last night? That affected conversation must be terribly boring. Everything is so restrained. Were you there long?
What are you talking about?
What?
What's all this mean? Are you trying out a part? Are you acting?
No, my dear, you are doing the acting. Why, you are even in costume.
Yes, I am, and I hope you realize why. Instead of begging my forgiveness, now that you're exposed, instead of realizing that the moment has come when even your lies are of no avail, you are... What does this mean? Doesn't this make everything clear?
Why, yes.
Well, then what are you doing?
What am I doing? I'm going on with our little comedy from where we left off last night. The comedy that I've been playing for your sake since yesterday afternoon. If you wish, we can keep it up, but I fancy we have had enough of it by now.
What are you saying?
You heard me perfectly well.
You mean you've been acting ever since yesterday afternoon?
Yes.
And you mean to say, great heavens, you mean to say now that you recognized me at once?
I not only mean to say it, I do say it. And not only do I say it, but it is true.
Well, that would be terrible if at the moment that you are caught, you escape.
You came in that door yesterday at exactly 16 minutes past 6. At 17 minutes past 6, I had recognized you. At 18 minutes past 6, I was wondering whether I should laugh in your face. And at 19 minutes past 6, I had decided to play the comedy to the end.
That is not true.
You poor fellow. You trust yourself to play a difficult part sufficiently well to deceive even me, and yet you don't trust me to play a much easier one, even though my acting ability is fully equal to yours. Better, possibly. If not, even...
We won't go into that. There are other matters. But if we should go into it, if we do begin to make comparisons, there isn't an actor in Europe who can touch my Romeo. You are a good Camille, my dear, but you must pardon me if I say I've seen better.
You've seen a better Camille?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you mean Dusa. Good. I agree to that.
Sarah wasn't exactly bad.
Sarah wasn't bad.
Although a certain critic, a dear friend of yours, wrote that you were better.
Sarah was better than I? And you say that now? Now for the first time after keeping it from me all these years?
Well, I thought that while you appreciated my art, it was my duty to appreciate yours.
I appreciate your art. You think I've seen no better Romeo just because I never said so? I won't tell you yet. I won't tell you the name of the man who was better than you. I'll just tell you where I saw him. Do you know where I saw a better Romeo than you? In a stock company in Schmatz.
I have just one thing to ask of you. Please don't drag my art into this discussion. I'm not discussing your acting.
Yes, you are. If you can play the guardsman so well that I believe in him, why couldn't I play the woman who believed in the guardsman well enough for you to believe in my belief?
Because I simply could not be recognized, no matter whatever you might say.
Why, even Mama knew who you were.
I don't care. You didn't. Prove it to me. How did I give myself away?
Well, let me see. Oh, yes, you gave yourself away when you praised your own cigarettes. No one else will smoke them.
But that doesn't explain anything. That doesn't mean anything.
And there are other things. Your kiss. But I mean this seriously. You couldn't disguise your kiss. It was so entirely your own. It was impossible not to recognize it.
Yes, I was afraid you recognized my kiss.
And then your eyes. What was it I told you that day when you first told me you loved me? What was it I told you about your eyes?
That the look in my eyes...
That sweet, warm, sad look.
That betrayed me.
Yes. You're looking at me like that now.
I don't want to.
Oh, if every man who wears a uniform was such a hero as you.
So I am to believe that you recognized me the very first minute?
The very first moment. You owe that to your peace of mind.
But
don't say if
but,
or buts. I warn you that if you do not believe me now, I have really nothing more to offer. This is the only... And besides, it's really true.
Then why didn't you tell me from the beginning?
Because I wanted you to play the comedy out to the end. I certainly didn't think you'd lack the courage to go through with it. I didn't think you'd rob us of that beautiful night.
Then you do love me.
And you will never put me to the test again?
Never again.
And you love me?
I am so in love with you.
Another Lunt and Fontan play was Howard Lindsay's melodramatic comedy about a mind-reading act, The Great Sebastians.
When we come to The Great Sebastians, what's our premise?
Well, this one was written 25 years after The Guardsman. It takes place during the Cold War. It takes place in Czechoslovakia, just as the communist takeover is going on. And they have an act. She is a mind reader, and he is the sort of interlocutor with the audience. He is Sebastian. She was previously married to Alexander, the great Alexander. And they're a very famous outfit, and they're very successful, but they find themselves kind of stuck in Czechoslovakia. And part of the play is about how the machinations they use to get out of the country and get back to safety.
And this scene is?
This scene is right at the end of the act when he has thought it wasn't going well enough, and so he has stayed on stage for 20 minutes something that, of course, Alfred Lunt would never dream of doing. And he's come backstage, and they talk about the act, and they talk about some of the codes that they use in order to fool the people into thinking that she is a mind reader.
Anything to add?
No, well, it just in the way that this play is constructed, it's so beautifully written. The codes that they run through in this first act are going to be instrumental in how they talk to each other in the presence of the communists who have imprisoned them in this grand mansion. And once the audience knows all that, it makes the second act that much more suspenseful for the audience that they know the code that these two are using. And most especially the key code is what they use to pass a key between them to get themselves out of a very bad situation. through a kiss.
Kissing.
By kissing and passing the key.
Okay.
But he has to cue her that that's what he wants her to do first. So that's, a lot of this stuff seems like it's nothing but comedy, but it's very, very carefully crafted.
It all
so,
pays off.
Yeah.
From the great Sebastians.
I'm surprised to see you here. I thought you were still out there doing a single.
Unless you learn a new code, that's exactly what I will be doing. A single.
There's one thing you've never learned, and it's about time you did. Always leave an audience wanting more.
They wanted more.
Not by the time we finished with them, they didn't. They were jolly well glad to be rid of us.
Ah.
You give too much. The great Alexander said, a good performer always leaves an audience hungry.
If you mention the great Alexander once
more... Now look, Rudy, our act is supposed to last 20 minutes. It says so in the contract. Why do you want to give them half again as much for nothing? It's not good business.
It is good business to know what we're doing out there.
I only missed once.
You missed three times.
What three did I miss?
I'll tell you, madam, if you please...
Necktie.
No, that's the old code. If you please is rubber boots.
Rubber boots.
Now, madam, if you please...
Rubber boots.
Now, madam, if you please...
Rubber boots.
Madam, if you please...
Rubber boots.
If you please...
Rubber boots. All right, all right.
Now, madam, there is a gentleman in the back. He's... holding up something. Can you tell me what it is? Quickly, madam, quickly.
No, you tell me.
Quickly is key. Key, K-E-Y, key. Now, madam, quickly.
Key.
Quickly.
Key.
Quickly.
Key, I know it now.
Well, you didn't know it out there. Now, madam, can you name this?
A scarf.
No, Essie, no, that's the old code again. It's now a fountain pen.
Why do we have to change the old code? I did it for 5 years with Alexander. Then after I taught you, we've done it for 20 years. Why do we have to change it now?
Because if we'd gone on using the old code much longer, the audience would have begun reading our minds. They're catching on.
The bright ones know it's a trick. They're not going to stop to figure it out.
We should have changed it 5 years ago. You're not in front of the audience, working the aisles. You can't hear them whispering.
Look at the money it's cost us. Bang went our Edie's wedding present when we had to lay off for 3 months to practice it.
Just the same, we're going on practicing it. Now, madam, without hesitation...
Where do we go from London?
From London we go to Munich. Now, madam, don't hesitate...
Where?
Munich.
Munich. Oh, grand. They love you in Munich, remember?
Yeah. Well, they've got that very good critic in Munich.
What was it he called you?
He called me the Swallow-Tailed Swami. Essie, you can't ask for more than that.
Oh, I don't know. He also said you were electric.
Yes, I was good.
You
wasn't
were
I?
Wonderful.
Oh, you were good, too.
Thank you.
So quick.
Quick, was I? Thank you again.
You seem to have the answers almost before I asked the questions. Oh, Essie, in Munich, I could have sworn you were really reading minds. In Munich, you have wunderschön. In München war es doch so schön, als wir uns liebten ungesehen.
Yeah, 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 aber in Munich we use the old code.
We are using the new code now. Now, madam, without hesitation. Madam, please do not hesitate. You see, Essie, you don't know
it. I do know it, teeth, and we'll never use it till the day we die.
Essie, have you forgotten that matinee? I caught a glimpse of an upper plate in a lady's handbag. It was you who said we should have a code word for teeth. I remember your very words. You said we'd have got the biggest laugh we ever got, and the woman would have fainted.
We haven't seen a tooth since.
That is not the point. Now, madam, would you care to...
November. It's not as good as the old code.
How can you say that? I have been working on this code for 2 years. How can you compare it to that kindergarten code of Alexander's?
Alexander was the greatest mind reader that ever lived.
If you please.
Rubber boots.
No. I don't mean that. I mean, I don't want to hear any more about your first husband, if you please.
Rudy, if there hadn't been a great Alexander, then there could never have been a great Sebastian. You know that.
Well, never mind. Now.
Now which? If it's now, madam, it's handbag. If it's now, Essie, you're going to be nasty.
Essie, we came all the way to Czechoslovakia to break in the new code.
We came all the way to Czechoslovakia so that you could take a few bows.
Bows? Me take bows?
Well, why not? It's your country. You worked hard enough for them during the war, broadcasting back here, keeping their spirits up. They were proud of you, and they should be. I was proud of you then. I'm proud of you now.
Are you?
Yes. You've had a good 3 months of showing off, and you've enjoyed every minute of it.
Showing off? Did I understand you correctly?
Cigar case.
No, Essie, no. That's the old code again. Now, you stop doing whatever you're doing, and we're going to rehearse.
Oh, no, we're not. We're going to finish packing up here, and then we're going to beat it to the nearest restaurant. I'm so hungry I could faint.
Whose idea was it not to have any dinner?
Well, Mr. Masaryk gave us such an enormous lunch, I felt we couldn't eat again so soon.
And you also felt that by doing that you'd save a few pennies, didn't you?
Yes, I did, but I made a mistake because I've worked up the most expensive appetite.
Well, before you eat, we're going to rehearse, and we're going on rehearsing. Now, madam, the subject. Can you visualize it?
I visualize a juicy steak.
James Pickering and Angela Iannone at Ten Chimneys with a scene from The Guardsman. Next, we're going to be hearing from the Florentine Opera of Milwaukee. That's right after this here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back now with William Florescu, the general director of the Florentine Opera in Milwaukee, and also with us, Rick Clark, who's the director of marketing and communications for Florentine. And we're looking at some of the recordings, an anthology of recordings from previous seasons of the Florentine Opera, which have some real highlights and, in fact, some Grammy winners in there, too. And welcome to University of the Air.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
I see sort of a classic literary theme as we look through some of these recordings. We'll look at, for example, for starters, a wonderful American classic called Elmer Gantry.
Yes, it's a work that we did that sort of set us on our new path. It premiered in Nashville in 2007, and I saw that world premiere, brought it here, and we decided to record it. And we were lucky enough to have that released on the Naxos label, and it went on to win two Grammy Awards. So it's really been sort of the bellwether for us for where we're going as a company.
You've got a pretty good idea now how to get those Grammys.
it's tricky, but it was a real thrill, and it put Wisconsin on the map in that regard. So we were happy to do that.
So what about Elmer Gantry? What's the premise, and what are we going to be hearing?
Well, it really just covers the first part of the Sinclair Lewis novel, basically up through when Sharon Falconer, the evangelist who's basically based on the historical Amy Semple McPherson, dies in a fire as Gantry has sort of won her over and then betrayed her, and he then sort of just moves on to his next version of hucksterism, but that's where the opera ends. But what we're going to hear is the love duet from Act Two, where he's finally won her over, and it's really very sincere at this point. I sort of liken it to Madame Butterfly. If you listen to the duet in Madame Butterfly, you have to put out of your head the fact that he goes on to betray her.
Right.
It's sincere at that moment in time, and I would say that's true about this love duet. And Gantry is very poetic in this duet. He says, "Oh, had I wings, Sharon, I would fly to you." It's a really touching duet that doesn't let you know what's going to happen after. But it's Keith Fares as Gantry and Patricia Risley as Sharon Falconer. Wonderful music.
Be at rest.
From a Grammy, a double Grammy-winning recording of the Florentine opera Scene, the Love Duet from Act Two of Elmer Gantry. And there are, other highlights that we could listen to and will listen to, in fact, in these recordings by the Florentine opera, including one that's probably a little less familiar with the storyline than the other two or three we'll be hearing from, Rio de Sangre.
Yeah, Rio de Sangre was written by Don Davis, who's famous as a film composer. He wrote the music for all three of the Matrix films.
Oh.
and this opera is an original story by a woman named Kate Gale, which was then translated into Spanish. And it basically uses as a theme the disappeared in Argentina. A dictator and how he's laid low and all of that. And so it's really, really very interesting story, very topical. It was our first opera in Spanish ever, as well as being the company's first world premiere ever in 2010, and Don was here for it. So really, I think a wonderful, tough story, but a very, very dramatic piece. And it also won a Grammy Award for Best Engineered Classical Recording in 2011. The year after Gantry won, and it's a really interesting story. But in any case, this scene that we're going to hear features Blanca, sung by Ava Pine, who's basically being kidnapped. She's the daughter of the dictator, and she basically is in this having a hallucination as she's being held in jail, and she imagines being in her wedding gown with her waiting for her husband Ignea, who's actually been assassinated. But she in the prison. She's hallucinating, trying to decide whether this white gown she's wearing is a wedding gown or a shroud. Hmm. And it's a really very atmospheric and very, very powerful scene in the opera. But again, very topical and something we were very proud of to do as our first world premiere.
Thank you.
from Rio de Sangre. That's Blanca's aria from Act 3, and it is a rather haunting piece of music, as befits the situation.
It's, again, another one of those operatic conventions have been made new again. It's a prison scene, which seems to happen a lot. Leonore and Il Trovatore, like that. It's fairly common, but made fresh and new again. So.
There's, I don't know if the word romantic is quite operative here, but there is this kind of strain of this kind of intense romance that comes through these operas, particularly if you look at one like Wuthering Heights. I mean, that's about as romantic as it gets.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Wuthering Heights is an interesting case because it's the two lovers who never really find each other. And when Carlisle Floyd, who just had, a lot of people were surprised when he wrote his second full-length opera, because Susanna, which is sort of the ultimate Americana opera, instead of going to another subject like that, he actually did something on a well-known English novel, Wuthering Heights. And one of the reasons we decided to record this and took on recording a lot of Carlisle's work, he's become very close with the company, was that this work, I think, has been unjustly neglected. It premiered in 1958. At Santa Fe and really hasn't made much of a murmur since. So, and this just, the recording was just released in June and has gotten great reviews. Opera News just gave it a wonderful review. And we're hoping that it really generates interest in it being done. 2018 will be the 60th anniversary of its premiere. So we're hoping it generates some interest. But a really wonderful opera, very atmospheric, which of course Wuthering Heights calls for. And I think a lot of people, as much as the book is well known, the 1939 film with Merle Oberon and Laurence Olivier is even better known, and the structure of the opera really matches the film to some extent. But there are so many different things that could have been chosen. But I thought the final duet, when basically Kathy asks Heathcliff to take her to the door so she can see the moors one more time and things like that, makes a really beautiful ending. And even though we did it in a concert version, the audience reacted to it. You would have thought they were seeing a Broadway musical in terms of how they reacted at the end of it. It's just a really powerful piece of music drama.
So this is a final duet then from Act 3.
Act 3, and with the great, wonderful Georgia Jarman, who's sung with this many times as Kathy, and Kelly Markgraf, who's sung quite a bit with Madison Opera as well as with us, as Heathcliff.
Gentlemen, thanks for stopping by and kind of catching us up on this recording, series of recordings that the Florentine Opera has done. Nice to get the word out about those a little bit. William Floresco and Richard Clark.
Really appreciate it, Norman. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.